We have a brief announcement in preparation for tomorrow's study. There is an additional outline of the book of Habakkuk on the back table. Please avail yourselves of these. It will give you some structure and some background focus that will help with the lesson on Habakkuk tomorrow. Sometimes the title of a lesson helps us to catch our attention and focus on the important theme that is before us, and so it is with this one. The lesson title is, It's Time to Get Off the Camel. Brother David.
Good morning again. We're very grateful for the message we just heard in the previous hour. I was especially gratified to see the connection between the lesson of the permission of evil as a sign of our Lord's presence. We're going to be talking about the Lord's presence this morning, but I'm not going to take the usual approach of proving this, that, and the other. We'd like to approach it from a different aspect. 2,000 years ago, there was a man with a message about a kingdom. A kingdom that would undo all around us the things which are evil, including death itself. His followers fell in love with him. They gave their souls to him and to his cause. They would hang on every word that he spoke. They would watch with worshipful admiration all the moves that he made. They virtually forgot everyday life as they were enraptured by him and by his ministry. But he died. And they were distressed and they were confused. But he arose from the dead. Their hearts were electrified by the prospects they thought would ensue. But he said, not yet. I must go away. But I will return. I will return with that kingdom. That's the story. That's the whole story. That's the vision which has held together those who had called themselves disciples of Jesus for the last 2,000 years. That is what brings us to this room today. All the other things that we might get embroiled in our dealings with each other, in our attempts to have successful ecclesias, all of that is all secondary. I don't want to say it's unimportant. It's not. It's all important. But it's all secondary to that vision of that kingdom. That is what has held the true saints together, Christians together, throughout the entire gospel age. That kingdom and having a part in it. It's not just the kingdom. The witnesses believe in the kingdom, but they don't believe they're going to have a part in administering it. They've lost the vision. It's the kingdom and a part with Jesus in administering it. That is what holds us together. That is the fellowship of saints. Everything we discuss, no matter how detailed, no matter how general, no matter how temporal, no matter how spiritual, all things are related to that one vision that we share. All other things are subservient and corollary to it. Study, prayer, self-growth, witnessing, doctrines, electing elders, working with others, everything, everything. If we lose that focus, those other things, those everythings, become out of proportion. They make us lose that first love, that thing which those disciples had that made them fall in love with Jesus and worship everything he did. So no matter how important any feature that we talk about might be in itself, it is never in itself. It is always related to that vision of the kingdom and our part in it. It helps us keep an equilibrium if we can remember that. That same vision, the story of the kingdom and our part in it, is the basic tool of the harvest time. True saints will respond to it. It's been the tool all through the age, but it is also the tool of harvest. There is not an honest heart toward God out there anywhere that cannot respond to that vision. That is the end in all. That is why we are consecrated. That's why we are disciples and followers of Jesus. Which, of course, brings us to the subject of the return. Jesus told his disciples, I'm going to go away, but I will return, and with me I will have that kingdom. And ever since those early days, those have been the words that have and should send emotional tremors through us. From the day that he departed, the brethren were looking for his return. Year after year, decade after decade, century after century. Oh, the apostate church didn't care for it. They had other things in mind. But the true saints have been looking and waiting. He said he'd come back. With it, he'd bring the kingdom. We're looking for that date. We're looking for that event. Even so, come, Lord Jesus, as the Bible itself ends. This should not be reduced to a mere doctrine. We have a list of beliefs, and I suppose if you had to list them, you'd list beliefs, and in them would be the return of the Lord. And that's fine, because everything we believe is a doctrine. But this is beyond that. This is much more vital. This is a subject of vital importance to every one of us, has been a subject of vital importance to the church throughout the age. We cannot become numb to it and say, yes, I believe the Lord returned. As if it is just another in a part of a list of doctrines that we say we can prove with the Scripture. Because that's not what it is. It must be a reality. In a sense, we should be as absolutely electrified as the disciples were when Jesus was raised from the dead. Because they anticipated that any moment he would establish that kingdom that he promised. What a disappointment when he said, no, not yet. I have to go away first. But I will come back. I will return. And those words have echoed throughout the centuries. Not just as a promise, but as an emotion. The return is the Laodicean message. We live in the seventh stage of the church, the end of the church. And there are many parts to this message, but more than anything else, rising far above it all is the fact that He has returned. If we are not invigorated by this, there's something wrong with us. Among other things, we're mentally living in the wrong stage of the church. Even in the preceding stage of Philadelphia, the brethren were looking. He's coming. He's coming. He's coming. And the Millerites got all excited about it. He's coming. And now we say, yeah, He's here. Somehow that doesn't quite do it, does it? It can't be one of those just little established facts of doctrinal accuracy. No. There's something very special going on in the world. And we know about it. So we can't just believe. We have to respond to our belief. We live in a very sanctified moment in the history of the world. You remember the story in Genesis about Rebekah getting on the camels to find Isaac. She finally saw him. And the moment she saw him, she got off the camel. And from that moment forward, her life was never the same. It's time for us to get off the camel. I know brethren interpret the camels as doctrines. That's fine. But this isn't a doctrine anymore. Now it's a reality. We have to get off the camel. She alighted off the camel and started changing clothes. Just says she put on a veil. That's when we go beyond the veil, I think. But the fact is, from this moment we get off the camel until the veil is secure, that's where we are living today. We don't want to do what happened after the Miller movement. The virgins fell asleep. And we can do that. And I don't mean that we're wrong. I don't mean that we're inaccurate when we say the Lord is here. But we can sure say it sleepily. It sounds like sleeping virgins sometimes. We have to get off the camel. We see Isaac. You remember Peter Coleman, some of you. And the hymn we'll sing at the close is one that I have in mind of hearing him sing. And the last words are, Zion, shout, the Lord is here. And when Brother Peter sang it, he didn't sing it. He shouted it. He didn't care whether the pitches were correct. They weren't. They were terrible. But the message was clear. Brother Peter loved the fact that the Lord was here. And he was shouting about it. And I think we have to learn to do that. Oh, I don't mean literally. But we've got to learn to talk with each other about what's happening. We've got to learn to talk to the world about what's happening. This is the major doctrine of this period of the church. I don't recommend, because decades of experience has shown me otherwise, that you just go up to somebody and say, you know what, the Lord's returned. That's not the best approach. But you know, there are many ways of saying that without saying it in a shocking way. Can't we say we can see the Lord's hands in earth's affairs? That's saying the same thing without the shock value, without making somebody think you're an absolute insane case. Think about it. See if you can make a list of 50 different ways of saying the Lord's here without saying it. And then as you have opportunity to talk to people who are talking about current events, maybe 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of those ways you think of will come into the conversation very easily. I'd be very surprised if you couldn't think of 50 different ways to say the Lord is here without saying it in those words. But we must first believe it. I don't mean believe it as a doctrine, but believe it so internalized as to make it a part of our daily life, our heart, not our head alone. 2 Timothy 4:8, interesting text. You know the text. Paul speaking. In the future there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. You see to whom the crown goes? It goes to those who love his appearing. Not his apocalypsis when he's revealed to the world. He won't get crowns for loving that. Everybody's going to love that. But crowns for those who love his appearing. His return. And all the saints will have loved it, from those back there that only saw it by faith all through the age, to those of us who experience it now at this time. But we've got to love his appearing, not just acknowledge it, not just say, yes, Jesus is here. That's not the point. Let's talk a moment to those who may be in this audience or may hear this on tape sometime, or you may talk to sometime, who are not yet sure or are not yet electrified by this most vital of events that's in our midst. We can check ourselves, see how our own barometers are doing. If you don't know that the Lord is present, why don't you know? Let me answer that question with another question. Do you want him to have returned? I know that's a very searching but a terribly important question. Do you want him to have returned? Or one reason we might not know about his return, maybe we don't so much want him to return as we want to have our own expectations about his return met. Is it possible, if you don't know for sure that Jesus is here, it's because your own expectations about his return are more important than the fact of his return? Is that possible? There is enough, more than enough, long established information to study about the Lord's return. Normally in the forms of chronology, signs of the times, Greek meanings. There is no excuse as far as lack of materials is concerned to say, I don't know whether the Lord's returned or not. There is no excuse as far as lack of materials is concerned. However, maybe you can't process that information. And I'm not saying this in a bad way, but we must realize all of our minds work very differently. And some people cannot process chronology. Some people cannot process Greek. Sometimes not even English. Some people can't process prophecy. But I'm going to say something now that sounds hard, but that's not a legitimate excuse. Because faith, that Brother Allen stressed so much this morning, faith asks those who can process it. If you are hungry, like the saints during the entire age have been, to say, when's the Lord coming? Is He coming? When's the Lord coming? I want the Lord to come. And if you can't read, you go to somebody who can. And you say, tell me, what do you know about the Lord's return? When's He coming? I can't read. Read for me. Wouldn't you do that if it meant something to you? Faith wants Him here. Faith doesn't want to doubt the evidences. Faith wants to swallow them whole. Faith, like Nathaniel had, just needs a word or two. That's all. It doesn't really need all of the intricacies. It needs to know enough. And if we can't read prophecy, if we can't cipher chronology, if we can't deal with Greek, find those who can and say, tell me my Lord is here. It's important to me. You know, the first thing that happened to Rebecca as she was bumping along on that horrible camel, she saw somebody out in the field. What did she do? She turned to Eliezer and said, who's that? Why did she say that? I suspect she said that about every man she saw along the road. But it's only recorded about the last one here because he's the important one. But that's the point. She didn't know what Isaac looked like. So she turned to somebody who did. Eliezer, who represents the Holy Spirit, and she said, tell me, who's that? And he said, that's the one. And did she say, oh, I want to ride this camel a little longer? No. She said, I want to get off. She got off the camel. It was time to get off the camel. She saw the one she was looking for. The traveling was over. Brethren, our traveling is over. Now, I don't know what she stepped in that field on the way to meet Isaac. And we have a lot of stuff to step in yet before the peaceable kingdom comes. But our traveling is over. We live in a most sanctified and wonderful moment. Well, suppose you don't know the Lord is here because you're new to finding the Lord and the truth and you just haven't had time. Okay, now I'm going to say but again. Isn't this kind of a priority question? It might be the first thing you want to solve. After all, that's what has held the body of Christ together, the return of the Lord. Get to it. Ask Eliezer. Get off the camel. Traveling is over. Once we believe, once we have gotten off the camel and realized this most magnificent of truths in our life, we can do something that most of our brethren throughout the age could never do, and that's we can look backward. I don't know whether you ever thought about that, but they were always looking forward, always looking forward, always looking forward. We can look backward. It's a remarkable change, and a rather nice one. You know, even in Brother Russell's day, well, they could acknowledge and rejoice in the Lord's return. A lot of prophecies they couldn't look backward on that we can look backward on. So much has happened. So little is yet to come to look forward to. Most of what we have we can look back at. And looking back is always clearer. Always clearer. The world has expressions about that. About Monday morning quarterbacking and so on. It's so easy to look back. And it is for us. The prophecies all open up now because we're looking back that most of them have been fulfilled. And it gives you a tremendous feeling of draining out of tension. Because you can see, you can understand, you can stand on solid ground, you can get off the camel, you can feel confident because the weight of accumulated prophetic interpretation is also certain looking back on it. I think it's a great blessing that the Lord has provided no future date. And I don't think he has. You remember the words in Matthew 24:35. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words shall not pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. Now through the age, maybe even in part of the harvest, that tended to be applied to the Lord's return. Now, I don't think that has anything to do with the Lord's return. If you read in the context, after all these signs are mentioned, the last one being the parable of the fig tree, the statement in context says, what's next? Heaven and earth will pass away. That's the dotted line on the chart. But of that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father alone. It is possible that Jesus himself, as the returned Lord, doesn't even know the date of the dotted line. It is possible, if we're reading this verse correctly. And that's to our advantage. That's that faith element that Brother Allen was bringing to our attention. We must wait. I know we're off the camel, but we must wait. And we must wait in faith, not hanging our hats on a date. There is a window of time here, 34th verse, this generation will not pass until all these things take place, which is related to that parable about the fig tree, the nation of Israel putting forth leaves. So I think we can safely say, if our interpretations be correct, and I think they are, that the generation which saw the reestablishment of Israel will not pass before heaven and earth pass away. But that doesn't give us a date. It just gives us a window of time. But a very exciting one, doesn't it? Very exciting one. It's a long, indefinite wait before the harvest saints were to see the peace be still. Even though we're off the camel, we are still waiting. I'd like to draw your attention to two texts that have to do with waiting. They're both in Revelation. They only occur twice, this statement. It's a wonderful statement, though. First time is in the 13th chapter. Verse 10. The end of verse 10. Here is the perseverance and faith of the saints. That follows that long description about that abominable 10-horned beast. who was given a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies and had power for 42 months to persecute and to do all kinds of terrible things. And it ends up with that statement, here is the patience and perseverance of the saints. The waiting that was brought to our attention this morning. That statement occurs one more time. One more time. In the 14th chapter, verse 12, here is the perseverance of the saints. And what does that follow? Look what it follows. Verse 8, fallen is Babylon, 1878. And then all these, if you do this, if you do that, you're going to get tormented. You're going to have it in the presence of the holy angels, in the presence of the Lamb. The smoke's going up. They don't get rest day or night. It's telling you this slow smoldering, because there are two kinds of fires in Revelation. There's the slow burning of Babylon, and there's the final big cataclysm. This slow smoldering has been going on for 120-some-odd years. Here is the patience of the saints that was drawn to our attention this morning. You've been waiting a long time. Now, there isn't one of us in the room that's been alive since 1878. So we haven't been waiting that long, have we? But we have been waiting, and we must yet wait. But waiting is not the same as losing excitement over the fact that our Master is present and doing things in the age. Let me take you aside now for a few moments for what I will call the exasperating details. I'm not going to go into a proof that the Lord has returned. You can do that. As I said, the material is inexhaustible to prove the point. But let's sort of refresh our minds. How do you know He's returned? Three ways. Chronology, number one. Number two, signs from prophecies. Number three, and it relates to the second one, certain Greek language prophetic clarifications. Number one, chronology. If I were to tell you before you received the truth, the Lord has returned, you would, if you just didn't pass me off as something you don't want to talk to, ask me one of two questions first. You'd either say, where is He? Or when? Those would be the first two things that would pop into your minds. So chronology is important because it answers the when. And if there were no chronology, the inevitable question, when? How do we know? Couldn't be answered. And if it couldn't be answered, you'd be uncertain. And Rebecca wouldn't have any Eliezer to turn to and say, is that He? And Eliezer would say, well, I don't know. It kind of looks like Him. That doesn't quite do it. Therefore, chronology is the most important evidence of the Lord's return because it is definite. But the date is not so important as the fact. I mean, after all, it's kind of like a recipe. How many of us read it once the cake is baked? The reason we deal with chronology is so we can witness to others and prove the point. We already know the fact. The cake is baked. After that point, the recipe is nice to keep in the drawer somewhere for when you need it. The chronology is inseparably linked to what we call the times of restitution of all things. That's why some of us are a bit adamant on the subject of the times of restitution. I don't think any of us who believe the times of restitution have begun believe that personal, mental, moral, physical restitution has begun. We don't believe that. That's not the point. The first restitution was the sending of Jesus Christ. That's why the times of restitution are important. Look at that text, which is the Bible student text. If we had to pick one, Acts 3. Acts 20:21. And that he may send Jesus. There's the point. That's what the church has been looking for so long. That's what Rebecca was looking for from her camel. That he may send Jesus, whom heaven must receive until the period of restoration of all things. That's why the times of restitution are important. That is the only direct statement about when Jesus returns. If you can prove when the times of restitution start, you know he's back. It is the only way we can do it. You may say, oh no, there's other things, like there's Daniel 12. But what does Daniel 12 say? Blessed is he that cometh for the 1335 days. Now what does that say? It says absolutely nothing if you don't know why it's a blessed date. That's a corroborative text. This one says Jesus comes when the times of restitution come. It is the only direct statement about when Jesus comes. And it is tied to the law about the Jubilee, which was a type of restoring all things. So if you wonder why brethren get nervous about the times of restitution or the Jubilee, that's why. It's the only direct proof, chronologically, of when Jesus returns. Signs. No, signs are very good. Signs can be quite convincing. But they can be and have been misinterpreted, misapplied. And they don't give a date. And because they can be misinterpreted and misapplied and don't give a date, people with strong enough faith can use that for the Lord's return. But people whose faith needs a little more bolstering need the chronology behind it. You know, we don't want to be like those that Peter in the second book, third chapter says. They'll say, where are the signs of his presence? Everything's been like this forever. Now, I'm going to say something that irritates me, and some of you probably have said it to me in the past, and you'll know why I look irritated when you say it. We can approach, though, that attitude of where are the signs of his presence? Everything's been like this as long as I can remember, which isn't very long. Sometimes I make statements like, this may be my last car before the kingdom. And I don't know whether it will be or not, but almost inevitably, the response is, oh, we've been saying that for years. Ooh! That just sends shivers up my spine. Maybe we have. But just think how many years closer we are. And I find the danger in that kind of response that we don't feel the imminence. I'm not saying the brethren that say that to me don't get the point. They probably do. But I'm just saying the effect it has on me, because to my mind it's saying, I know he's here, but maybe a long time. And that's not how a bridegroom, that's not how a bride anticipates her bridegroom. That's not the way we do it. So, we ought to think about our little reactions to questions about the presence. Since we're talking about signs, I only want to talk about one here. Matthew 24 again. You remember, the disciples said, "What will be the sign of your presence and of the end of the age?" And I'm sure if you studied Matthew 24 in volume 4, which has all the answers, the only place I've ever seen that does have all the answers, you realize that Jesus never answers that question in Matthew 24. Never directly. He answers it indirectly in verse 30. "And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heaven." He doesn't tell you what the sign is. He tells you when it will appear. He tells you where it will appear. If you study that carefully, and because of Brother Russell's modesty, it's not plainly stated in Volume 4. It's there if you look for it. That sign is the seventh messenger to the church, who appeared at the right time and in the right place. He is the sign of the Lord's return. Let's go to Greek. Now, many of us, myself included, are really sorry that we have to look into a foreign language. But the import is great. There are all kinds of instances, even in today's world, where it makes a difference how you translate things. Even General Motors had a problem with it. In Germany, when they started manufacturing cars in Germany, somebody over there who, probably an American who spoke German, not a German who spoke American. You know how you open the GM car and on the threshold, what's it say? "Body by Fischer." Well, you know how they translated it into German? "Corpse by Fischer." Somehow their sales weren't doing too well. Translations make a difference. They really do. If you go to Philippines and ask for a hot dog, that's probably what you're going to get, literally, because they eat dogs. Translations make a difference. One little word can make a difference. So we have to look at Greek sometimes. And there again, we have to rely on Eliezer. We have to rely on the Holy Spirit's using people who can do it, because most of us can't do it reliably. So we really have to give in and learn a couple of Greek facts. Although, I love again Brother Coleman's statement. Somebody asked him if it really helps to read Greek, which he did. And he'd shake his finger and he'd say, "Remember this. The truth was written in the original English." And he had a point. You know about parousia and presence. I don't want to say any more about it than this. It would stand up in a court of law. We're not dealing with somebody's opinion about this word. It would stand up in a court of law. So don't bother arguing about the meaning of parousia if you don't believe it. If you don't believe it, it's because you simply haven't looked into the matter. It would stand up in a court of law. But I do want to take a second word here. One that Brother Russell brings up in the second volume and is almost never mentioned from the platform, but in three different instances really makes a difference. And that is the Greek word hekō, which is also translated coming. I guess in English we'd spell it H-E-K-O. Very important word, generally a little bit ignored. The new American, well, I call it the new American standard Strong's. It's not Strong's because Strong didn't do it. But it's very much like Strong's. It's exhaustive, and the numbers are the same as Strong's, and sometimes the definitions are a little bit better. It defines this word as to have come. Not to come, but to have come. That little word have in there makes an enormous difference. Strong's itself is not quite as clear. He explains it as to arrive. But you could misunderstand that. He does add, however, to be present. So you get the idea that this arrival is complete. It's not on its way. Vines explains it this way. He says, erkomai signifies the act, in contrast with heko, which stresses the arrival. And then he makes up his own sentence to give you the idea. He says, I am come and am here. No question about that, is there? We're not talking about the traveling. We're talking about the fact that it has come. Thayer defines it as to have come, to have arrived, to be present. Now, I've gone through all the instances in the New Testament for my own benefit, and sometimes only a very insignificant change to the meaning comes by applying this rule about heko. Sometimes, however, it's great. What I'd like to do first is give you 5 instances that demonstrate the point of what it really means. Very quickly, Mark chapter 8. Two and three. I feel compassion for the multitude because they have remained with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their home, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from a distance. You can see why it's translated have come, because the fact is they were already there, weren't they? For 3 days they'd been there. That's that Greek word heko. By the way, in these 5 instances I'm giving you, the translators do it right. When they get to the 3 important prophetic texts, they do it wrong. Does that tell you something? They know what this word means. And they insist, when it's important, in misdoing it for some reason. Luke 15, 27. Another example of a correct usage. And he said to me, your brother has come and your father has killed a fattened calf because he received him back safe and sound. It's not your brother's coming for dinner. Your brother has come. The father saw him already there and then he killed the fatted calf. That's heko. John 2:4. Another example of a correct usage. Woman, what do I have to do with thee? My hour has not yet come. Now, that's the negative form, but the point is his hour wasn't there yet, and that's the correct usage. John 8:42. If God were your Father, you would love me, for I proceeded forth and have come from God. He was already there, wasn't he? He wasn't on his way. For I have not even come, that's a different Greek word, on my own initiative. And you can see why that second one's a different Greek word. Because it could refer to the fact of the journey itself. Different word. 1 John 5:20, our last example of correct usage. And we know that the Son of God has come. Past tense. And has given us understanding in order that we might know him, and so on. All right, you have seen 5 instances of the use of heko where the translators did perfectly fine with it. Now let's look at 3 where they just really ruin it. And they're the 3 that count. Matthew 24:50. This is in that context about who then is that faithful and wise steward. And then the evil one in 48. Verse 50. The master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him. Oh, come on. Doesn't that destroy everything? The whole point is this evil slave has denied the fact that the Lord's already there. And this verse says, will come. It's heckle. And they left the have out. The master of that slave will have come. It's already there. I don't know why they ruined it, but it changes the meaning entirely. Luke 12:46, a similar context. 12:46. The master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him. Should we will have come? That's what the word means. 2 Peter 3:10. Now this one's extremely important. 2 Peter 3. By the way, I'm using a New American Standard, but I think the King James is wrong too. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief? No! That spoils it. It's heckle. The day of the Lord will have come like a thief. Put that in the context when you get time and see what a difference it makes. Makes all the difference in the world. All right, let's get off Greek. The last part we'd like to talk with you about is after the camel ride. By the way, if you want to read the account, it's in Genesis 24, verses 64 and 5. We're off the camel, but we don't have the veil yet. We wouldn't be in this room if we had the veil. What should we be doing if we're in love with this bridegroom of ours? I would suggest that we're going to rush to the newspapers. We're going to rush to the news magazines. We're going to rush to the television news. We're going to rush to the radio news. We're going to rush to see what people are thinking, because we want to know what he's doing now. However, we rush to those places, we only get what our eyes see. So we've got to rush to the prophecies to interpret the events that we're hearing about and seeing. That's what we ought to be doing if we're hungry to know what our bridegroom is doing. Is that he that's doing that? Is that he that's doing that? And Eliezer has the answers. We ought to rush to see what to do next, or what to look for next, rather. We have to read the program. The Lord's prepared a program in advance. Look at Revelation 1:1. I had a glitch here in my study of Revelation. You know, almost all Bible students, not all, but almost all Bible students, look at the first period of the stage, church as being Ephesus from about 33 maybe to about 100, something like that, with Paul being the messenger to the church. And the real question in my mind was based on Revelation 1:1, where it says, things which must shortly take place. Now, John wrote this close to 100 A.D., and it says in the first verse, these are things which must shortly take place. Now, Paul was already dead. And the Ephesus church was just about gone. What's wrong? What's wrong, of course, was me. I wasn't reading it right. Let me answer that question first and then come back to verse 1. Look at verse 19. One of the things which Jesus tells John to do. Write therefore the things which you have seen, past tense, and the things which are happening right around you at the moment, and the things which shall take place after these things, prophecy of the future. John was explicitly told to write about the past. And the only thing that we can find in Revelation about the past is the Ephesus stage of the church. So if verse 19 is true, we're very justified in saying Ephesus applied to the time before John ever wrote Revelation. So what does 1:1 mean when it says things which must shortly come to pass? Here's what it means. It means, I have given this book, John, to my saints to show them, not just now, John, while you're alive, but also in Smyrna and in Philadelphia and in Laodicea. Whenever they pick up this book, they will see things which must shortly come to pass. It's the program for the gospel age. We want to know what Jesus is going to do next? It's in here. All we need to do is compare it with what's happening outside the window. All right, our closing here. There is a deplorable disarray among the virgins. But the work is going on. I would suggest there are 7 ongoing harvest efforts at the moment. There's the Elijah work to Israel. If we can't do it, we can support it. There is the gleaning of the final members of the body. If we aren't good at it, we can support it. There's the personal polishing of our own characters to put on the veil. I can't say if we can't do that. If we can't do that, we're lost. But we can support it in others. There's the helping the great multitude to find itself. Now, I don't mean you point to somebody and say, well, there's a great multitude member. But the fact is, the great multitude is going to outlive the church. And they need information to go on. So if we're talking to spirit-begotten people, we're helping them find some bearings that once their eyes open a little wider, they'll have understanding and they won't have to go digging too deep to find it. We're helping to bind the tares. When you give a tract to somebody and he throws it right back to you and runs to his priest, you've just bound him in a little bit tighter. We're helping to spread the message of truth, which acts as a judgment over error. So you don't always spread truth just to find saints, but the Lord wants people to know that what's going on is wrong. And the only way they're going to know that is if there's truth in contrast to it. And the 7th work that's going on is scattering seeds for the kingdom. Primary or secondary, don't despise any of these. It's the Lord's work, whether or not any of them are ours personally. Remember Revelation 14:13, our works have to follow after us, which means we better be doing some. There are 2 extremes among us today. Extremes which may make us suffer loss. One on the right, one on the left. We can lose the truth. We can lose the spirit of the truth. And quite frankly, the adversary doesn't care which one it is. We lose the truth by being too ecumenical. Look at Revelation again, very quickly. And I don't know the origin of this. Maybe somebody does, but the origin at the moment isn't important in my mind. But look at chapter 17 and chapter 19. I don't know where it came from, because I don't think the really old manuscripts have it, but there are Greek manuscripts that do, and most English Bibles do. What pops out at you? Big, great big, bold print. The only two great big bold prints in the whole New Testament. What are they? One is Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. The other is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Which bold print do you want to be helping? Let's not get too ecumenical. We'll lose the truth. If we want to lose the spirit of the truth, we can value the information over the application. Now, I know, brethren, I know whole ecclesias that in my sight tend to seem to do this, valuing the information over the application. And you know, they always look angry. I don't know why. That's a terrible attitude to be in. They always look upset because somebody's dirtying the truth. And I don't want to dirty the truth, but I sure don't want to be angry all the time. I'll leave that to the Lord. You remember the pounds and the talents? Each one ends up with this one holding something, and he goes to the Lord and says, "Look, Lord, I kept the truth beautiful. It's just like you gave it to me." And what does he say? Oh, he says, "You poor, miserable beast." The Lord didn't give it to us to keep it beautiful. He gave it to us to apply. And in applying, it may get dirty. Not on any intentional basis, but in applying it, it will grow. Now, last sentence. I think we can be protected from both of these extremes by seeing and responding to Isaac in front of our eyes. Let's get off the camel, get our eyes fixed on what really counts, and those extremes, by the Lord's grace, may not bother us.
Lift up your eyes, for your deliverance draweth nigh. Thank you, Brother Duran. Remember to pick up a copy of the Habakkuk background information. Also, there are some extra pharmaceutical items you may wish to avail yourself on the back table. We have come to the noon hour. And again, for those that have made reservations, there are tickets available as you go into the restaurant. This noon will be a buffet style. So if we all arrive at one moment, there's going to be a long line. So perhaps there not need to be such a rush. And if you go in...